Welcome back to Lake Effect. Great to speak with you again.
Yeah, likewise, Mitch. Thank you so much for having me.
So how was your perception of being a grown-up shaped by your own upbringing?
I had different conceptions of grown-ups. I sometimes thought they were kind of scientists, like astronauts were grown-ups, people who could do things that seemed really hard or really technical or really scientific. I guess I defined it as anything vaguely competent that I was not able to do. And I thought grown-ups had this kind of wisdom and insight and discernment and an ability to wrap their heads around social dynamics and conversations, and they knew what was happening. I felt like I never quite had a handle on what was happening all around me. And so it was this combination of judgment and expertise, I think. That was my grown-up category. And I rarely met actual adults who were like this. But I think I was so eager for there to be grown-ups in the world that I projected the status onto people who probably didn't even deserve it.
It's like the belief that grown-ups are the ones who did the reading.
Yeah, or who know what the reading should be. Or like I'm a journalist. I've worked for newspapers my whole life, but I always feared being an editor, because an editor is the one who knows what's important, what should go on the front page. And I thought everything seems important to me, or I would turn the whole paper up. If it was just up to me, I would never kind of get into the group mind and know what was important. But then I later realized that, in fact, like, it's basically an editor at AP who sets all this, and you kind of compare yourself to other newspapers, and no one really knows. That's the crazy thing you kind of learn when you get older, is there is no objectively important story, usually. I mean, in most cases. Although that's not necessarily the case anymore.
But there's a big overlap with the concept of imposter syndrome when it comes to feeling like a grown-up.
Yes. And I think for women, it's especially strong. I mean, I was struck when I was working on this book by how many incredibly accomplished women I interviewed who privately confessed, kind of when I agreed to change their name or not mention what university they taught at, that they do not feel at all qualified. I interviewed this one woman who said she doesn't think she's going to get tenure, and she certainly wouldn't blame them because she doesn't deserve tenure because everybody in her department is much smarter than she is. And I thought, you're crazy. I've read the things you've written. You're brilliant. You know, and then I thought, well, maybe I'm just confusing being a grown-up with being a man. Because, I mean, there are men with imposter syndrome, but it doesn't seem kind of baked into the recipe as much as it does with women.
Well, so I gather this kind of introspection really begins for you, and it's sort of a recurring theme through the book, with a shift in how people address you living in France. There's this shift from mademoiselle to madame. Can you talk a little bit about the significance of what that means in that culture?
I mean, it technically mademoiselle means unmarried woman. But there's somehow this moment when you go from, I mean, I moved to France when I was in my early 30s, and I was mademoiselle everywhere. And it's not like in the States, or even like it is in the South in the States. You know, people call you, you walk into a cafe just for coffee, and people will say mademoiselle everywhere all the time. And then suddenly, around the time I turned 40, there was this really collective switch where at first it was madame, but kind of ironically with a little wink. And then about 2 weeks later, I could swear that like every single person, every single waiter, every single stranger suddenly started calling me Madame, almost at the same time, as if they had somehow like taken a vote on it that I didn't know about. And it was so universal. I mean, I remember like a homeless person on the street calling out Madame to me and thinking, "What? That this person is like wants money from me and thinks this is polite to call me Madame." And I thought, well, I definitely do look like Madame now. And what does this mean? I mean, I don't feel any different on the inside. I kind of, you know, like, and it was so, like, I still have literally like milk in my refrigerator that has not expired from the mademoiselle days. So what kind of transformation is this? And what really has changed? Like, have I changed on the inside too? Is this just a kind of, the world is treating me like I'm a grown-up now. I could see that I couldn't get away with the same behaviors as a madame as I could as a mademoiselle. I couldn't like be sort of adorably clueless anymore, or you know, kind of run in saying, oh, I'm so sorry, I didn't realize the appointment was half an hour ago. And people look at me like I was nuts because I look like an adult who's supposed to arrive on time and have all the correct paperwork and take care of children. But then I started to realize that I actually did feel a little bit more Madame on the inside too, in some cases in bad ways, but also in some good ways too, that it wasn't just an exterior shift, that there had been a corresponding interior shift too. And so I want, so the book is really exploring those changes and what they mean and what, really trying to put my finger on what they are.
Well, and I wonder if it helped to be living in France at this point in your life, because the Mademoiselle to Madame shift puts things into such sharp relief where you might not have gotten that in the United States, or it might have been more subtle.
Uh-huh. Except for the selfie. The selfie is a problem. But yeah, I mean, they really put it on the table here. And it's funny because French feminists say, when I tell them about my shift and how it was a problem for me, they say, but we've been fighting for so long to get rid of Mademoiselle. They could, because they don't really have a Ms. equivalent. So they want to be Madames in a way. But even the feminists, if you really, you know, kind of give them a glass of wine and ask them about it, they'll say, yeah, I wasn't thrilled to suddenly be to lose my Mademoiselle status.
What surprised me is that there has not been a ton of kind of broad-based academic study in this field. You sort of had to piece what people had written about a variety of aspects it together.
Yeah, I mean, there has been quite a lot since the 1990s of psychological research into midlife. It's a fairly new, in quotes, period of life because lifespans have been expanding so much that, you know, in the 1950s, people weren't studying midlife because it didn't last as long. And certainly in the 1900s, midlife, you know, you were lucky if you lived to 60. But now someone who's 40 has a 50% chance of living to 95. So there's this whole chunk of time, this whole stage of life that is there to be investigated. But I would say there's quite a lot of writing and research into the neuroscience of being in your 40s and 50s. What happens to your brain then? What happens to different aspects of your personality? They study things like conscientiousness and neuroticism and other qualities. But I hadn't read anything that really described the kind of constellation of experiences that one goes through if one is somebody like me. And so I really wanted to read that book. And in order to read that book, I had to, unfortunately, go through the bother of writing that book.
Well, and I gather even within your own household, you know, your husband wasn't necessarily introspective about that particular time in life in the same way that you were.
My husband started calling himself middle-aged when he was about 32. he's a bit curmudgeonly, and I think he has been, if I can like glean anything from the pictures of him when he was like a toddler, he seemed to have like been born that way. Whereas I always thought of myself as young. I'm not boasting here, but I skipped kindergarten. And I somehow, even though it's just a year and it didn't mean anything at the time, I had an early birthday. I always felt like I was always the youngest in my class. And I always felt like I had this secret year and I was, and then suddenly I hit my 40s and everyone is younger than me. And I think I had an exaggerated sense of my own youth. And the other thing was that I always looked younger than I was, which, you know, becomes, you know, I never thought about when I was a teenager, but when you're in your 30s, you think, oh, everyone still thinks I'm 25 and bartenders still ask me for my ID. And I thought this will go on forever. And then It stopped going on. I hit the wall somehow.
Well, and you write this, and I think there's not anyone who is in their 40s that hasn't thought this at some point in their 40s that, oh my God, there's no way I can be a wonder kid anymore. You know, I
yes.
can't be developmentally ahead of things anymore.
Right. There's no, you're not a prodigy at anything in your 40s. I mean, for me, the moment was when someone younger than me was nominated to the Supreme Court. I thought, yeah. Okay, there's nothing I can do.
Right.
But yeah, and there's also you kind of enter a period of life without milestones. I write this about this in the book as well, that, you know, in your teens, in your 20s, in your 30s, you're jumping through hoops. You're getting jobs, you're getting your driver's license, you're graduating, and there are all these older people who are your sort of parents or mentors really cheering you on and applauding you. And then you hit your 40s and your mentors are having their hips replaced or they're worried about their own problems. They're retired or they don't want to think about you anymore. And they're younger people who you're expected to mentor and to cheer on, and whether they're kids or they're your students or they're just younger people in your life. So you're kind of in this like weird, you can still accomplish things in your 40s, but you've entered this kind of, it's as if almost you've entered the future, this time of life that you've been preparing for all these years. It's like in the book, I describe it as the kind of the thing itself.
Right.
You finally entered real life. And you kind of have this realization that if there's something you're planning to do, you know, in the future, one day, now would be a pretty nice time to get on it. One of the things I say in the book is, you know, you're in your 40s when having older friends no longer makes you feel young.
Right.
Because it used to, yeah, because they're old, you know, they start to be really old and you think, oh, that's what's coming.
I feel like I was, I feel like I was both laughing and crying all the way through this book. One of the things that was especially interesting, and I gather this is really a gender issue as much as anything, or maybe it's just that, that women might think about it more, is the understanding of what you want out of your wardrobe. And I found it fascinating to read how the French treat what they wear versus what how Americans approach dressing in a way that suits them, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it absolutely does. I had this moment when I turned 40 where I just didn't know what to wear anymore. I would kind of stand in front of my closet for as long as I could each morning, putting things on and off and saying, that doesn't look great. That doesn't. And it wasn't that my weight had changed, or it was just like nothing quite suited me. It didn't look right next to my middle-aged or newly middle-aged face. And I think in your 40s, basic clothes, like a little black dress, or it can look a little bit too basic. You kind of get lost in it. And what I think, because I interviewed a lot of stylists and kind of fashion experts for this book, what dressing well in your 40s takes is a real understanding of yourself. You have to dress in a way that's specific to you. And it means understanding not just what you don't like about your body, which I think there's a tendency in America to, you know, we do this fat talk where we, you know, even if we're not overweight, we talk about how fat we are and other people affirm that or disagree with us. And you tend to have these kind of women, especially have these kind of no-go areas in their body that they don't even want to think about, that they're horrified by. And that doesn't work in the 40s because you have to know your own body really well. You have to know what your assets are and dress to, show those off.
And I think the idea that Americans have this pressure on themselves to, you know, make their wardrobe, make them somehow unique doesn't exist everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, that was, I interviewed this American stylist who said all of her clients start out by saying they want to look unique. Because I think in the American feminist story, the idea is that you remake yourself, you can be anything you want. And you're almost obliged to invent yourself, including your own sense of style, from scratch. It shouldn't be derived from anyone else. And that's just, for most people who don't have fashion design degrees, not a very realistic aspiration. It's very hard to see yourself clearly, to know exactly what to be able to do that. And I think the French idea of that is your sense of style grows naturally out of your own body and what looks good on you. And there's certain types of clothes or silhouettes or styles that look good on certain body types. And so if you have that body type, you'd be, you know, kind of smart to go in that direction. And you don't have to. They also don't think, you know, in their feminist story, women aren't inventing themselves from scratch. And the fashion equivalent of that is that you don't have to dress kind of and invent your sense of style from scratch. For me, the moment came when I just walked into this boutique in my neighborhood and just threw myself at the mercy of the French saleswoman there, which I'd never done before, and just said, please help me. I have no idea what to wear. And she looked me over, and in about 15 minutes, she had put me in what became my new uniform. It was, I mean, I won't bore you with the specifics, but it was basically skinny jeans, a small pump, and blazers in kind of shades of navy blue. And it wasn't terribly original or unique, But I saw immediately that that's what suited my morphology, and I've worn versions of it ever since.
Can you explain the concept of, I think it's called Nunchi, and how it fits in the dynamic of growing up?
Sure. Well, Nunchi is a Korean word, which I hope I'm pronouncing correctly, which means the ability to see clearly what's happening, to read unspoken signals and understand social dynamics without them being spelled out for you, and kind of understanding what other people want and are experiencing without them telling you. And I read a lot of studies on versions of Nunchi. It's a highly prized quality in East Asian cultures, not just in Korea, but also in Japan and elsewhere. And it's not a quality that Americans emphasize, and certainly not that American parents emphasize when they're raising kids. What we emphasize, these studies show, is understanding our own experience and our own preferences and what we like to do and read and eat. Whereas in an East Asian setting or culture, people might be very alert to what's happening in the surrounding social dynamics. In America, we're much more focused on ourselves, and that gives us a different reading of what happens, a different sense of things.
Would you think that Americans could do with a little more dose of Nunchi?
Well, I learned about Nunchi because I have a friend who was born in Korea but raised in California, and she said her parents are constantly complaining that she doesn't have good enough Nunchi and she should just kind of read the room a little bit more. And she said that's a complaint that a lot of Korean parents have about their American raised kids. And yeah, I think my Nunchi has improved as I've gotten older, because as you get older, even as an American, your level of neuroticism declines, and that kind of opens the channel for you to have a better sense of what's happening with other people and know what they're thinking.
Do you feel like you're happier or maybe more at ease with yourself for having gone through the process of writing this book?
I think absolutely. I mean, I really, at one point when I was writing this book, I kind of locked myself in a hotel room for about 10 days, and I said, I'm not coming out of this room until I've created some order and figured out kind of the structure of my own childhood so I could tell the story and understand where I came from. And I did that. And I feel like it might not be the only version of what happened to me growing up, but it's one that I'm glad to have in my pocket now. And I feel wiser for having written the book.
Well, I think all of us kind of feel wiser for having read it.
Oh, that's very sweet of you, Mitch. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And let's talk again.
Thank you.